Carol Berg is the Mythopoeic Fantasy Award-winning author of the Collegia Magica series. The most recent book in the series, The Soul Mirror, was published in early 2011. The next book in the series, The Demon Prism, will be published in January 2012 by Rock.
So tell us a little bit about this panel, the point of view panel.
The point of view panel. Well, it was there were many, many aspiring writers in the room, and they had lots of questions. But, of course, we had to get in first and talk about, the differences between first person and third person point of view and the difficulties of each and which one we like to write and why and what difference we thought it made and pitfalls, of which there are many, and surprises. You know, when my first book came out and it was in first-person point of view, I had some readers write me and say, I've never read a book in first-person point of view that I liked, and it surprised me.
That's very interesting. Nick, do you want
to? Yes. So you do the Collegia Magica series, am I saying?
Yes,
right?
Yes.
So a new book in that series is coming out in January. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
It's the third and final book. I call these books my double agent murder mystery set in a Renaissance-like world where science is pushing magic to the margins of society.
That is a perfect elevator pitch.
That's well probably rehearsed. The only one I've ever done. But it sort of came out of the fact that I've always loved writing. I love reading mysteries. It's one of my favorites to read. And I realized that every one of my books, so this will be these three books are my 11th, 12th, and 13th books. And none of my other, all my books have mysteries in them, but none of them had ever been a story where the plot was actually driven by the investigation of a murder. And so I decided that that's what these would be about. Sure. And of course, it became something much bigger.
As these things are wont to do.
As they're wont to do. That's right.
Was there a particular inspiration or anything that sparked that to decide to make the mystery element kind of a bigger part of the story?
I love reading mystery. And as I said, every one of my books has some sort of mystery, whether it's a person finding out what his place in the world is or finding out why people are chasing him or, you know, this, that, or the other. And I had a character who was left over from some of my early writing, which will never see the light of day. But there was some...
Contrary to fan demand, I'm sure.
It will not. It doesn't matter who asks. No. But in some of those early stories I wrote, there was a character that I absolutely loved, and I thought he was well-defined, and he's hung around in my head all these years saying, find me a story, find me a story. I call him my broody necromancer, and he's a sorcerer with a very unhappy past in a very unorthodox way. So in this very orthodox society of this sort of late Renaissance time frame, he's a loner. And so he was hanging around, and sure. I wanted to find him a story. And I thought, well, you know, it would be kind of interesting to have him brought in to help investigate an attempted murder.
And
it actually was an attempted murder.
Yeah.
Yes. And so then, of course, I had to go find somebody to tell the story because I wasn't ready for him to speak as yet.
Right.
But actually in book three, The Demon Prism, the new one, he actually does tell a part of the story.
Oh, and hence the viewpoint.
Yes.
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 Mm-hmm. So I was reading a bit on your blog about the new cover of Song of the Beast.
Yes.
And so you said it was a little bit broody and you weren't quite sure about it. And, you know, that kind of was making me wonder about, you know, the freedom of, you know, how much freedom authors get in their book covers.
None. Unless you're really, really big. Right. You know, if you're J.K. Rowling, you can say what covers you will have in what countries. For most of us... we worm our way into the favor of our editors and our production people. I've been at Rock. All 13 of my books have been published by Rock, which is a division of Penguin Putnam. And, of course, as a newbie, I pulled out my first cover out of an envelope and looked and went, oh. There were nice things about it, but in general, it was totally wrong.
Did you just feel it didn't represent the book, or are you worried it wouldn't sell?
I mean, it was just, the character was just totally wrong, mm-hmm. and gave total misimpression about what the book was. And I have
a successful career and 13 books later.
I've had many people tell me that they either didn't read it until the second book came out, or that they were really tempted. If a friend hadn't told them that they really, really liked the book, they would never have picked it up. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I did get the second and third book had extremely fine covers, and I think that really helped me survive. But so at that point, I did. The only time I saw the cover was when I got the final product. Mm-hmm. After that, gradually, my editor would ask me about, this sketch or that sketch, which do you think represents more the feel of the book? And then she might ask, what scenes do you think should be depicted? And I found that I was not too pushy, because I have no contract rights to say anything or reject or anything, but I figure working nicely, playing nicely, that people would listen. And then I changed editors during the time of my seventh book, which turned out to be a disastrous cover, because I think it sort of fell into the cracks between these two, and that my new editor felt so bad about that one that she has since solicited my input on what scenes I think should be depicted and what characters looked like. And that's worked pretty well until this last one, where I sent in, so I got to where I would send this in automatically, and unfortunately on this last one, he didn't come out looking at all like my broody necromancer.
That had been in mind for many, many years.
It's a very nice cover, and I've gotten wonderful covers.
He was supposed to have been in a prison for a while, too, and he kind of came out.
Now, that's Song of the Beast, where they redid the cover. That was actually my fourth book out, and I liked the cover of that, the original mass-market paperback cover. When they decided to go back and reprint it in a trade paperback version, they wanted to do a slightly newer style cover and update it. There's sort of a distinct difference between trade paperback covers and mass market, the small size paperback covers. And so they wanted to redo it. And so when I saw that one, the character would never wear the things that the man is wearing on the cover. The dragon's wonderful. But the overall feel, I have learned through the years, don't quibble about do they look exactly like the cover. As long as they look good, that's probably okay.
Yeah. Having had four successful series now and being this far, do you find that your relationship with your editors, with the publishers, you're on better footing and you're able to exert more, creative control?
I've never had a problem with creative control of my writing, which is the most important to me. Absolutely. I've had two very wonderful editors who have allowed me to stretch my genre. they've offered only the best kinds of comments on the book and have left me full freedom to do what I wanted. The only knuckle wraps I ever get are for being a little bit too long, which if I sold a lot more books wouldn't be a problem, because it's not from my readers. It's generally, we're going to have to charge $1 more or something like that. Yeah. But I've had two wonderful editors, and so I have no restrictions on what I write about, on where the story goes, on
even which series character you're writing in. If you wanted to continue the Collegia books, would you?
Now that's a matter of proposing something and having them buy it. Mm-hmm. And so far, they have bought what I've proposed.
Yeah.
And right now, this is the end of a contract, so I'm working on a new proposed series, and whether it'll fly or not, whether I want to do it or not, I'm not sure yet.
Sure.
But I've sort of been writing it. But so far, what I've offered, they've wanted. Mm-hmm. And we'll see. the next one's a little bit different. I'll say that I was so intensely involved with these three books for about 4 years, and then before that, Flesh and Spirit and Breath and Bone, it was one book that turned into two, and that I've been writing so intensely now for about 7 years, and certainly before that, I wasn't slouching around either. But those particular, the two book series and then the three book series, they were really an intense experience. And so right now I'm kicking back. I'm not rushing the new proposal. Yeah. So
Demon's done.
Demon is done, yes. Right. Just a few weeks ago I reviewed the galley proof, so the actual typeset pages, and read it through from beginning to end, which I hadn't done all that many times. I'd read every part of it, but and I always tweak words until the very end. I'm a real word tweaker, because sometimes just the nuance of a word can make the whole scene different. And so I was doing that, but you can't do too many once it's typeset. You get in trouble if you mess around with it.
Is it too early to tell us a little bit about what to expect from this book, or?
Well, I don't want to give away the ending for anyone who's read book two and knows where it ended. The person that Anne was visiting at the end tells the story. Well, actually,
okay.
My broody necromancer tells the story. he begins the story, and he's in a sort of a bad way. But in essence, a man comes to him with a dream that's been bothering him. He's an old soldier, and he comes, and he's heard that Dante can investigate dreams, and that he can actually take dreams away. And he tells him the story of a dream, of an experience he had as a soldier some 19, 20 years in the past, about a woman in a deserted city in the desert, a ruined city in the desert, who was standing on a stone in the middle of a white lake, and she had a green jewel in her hand and was begging him to come and rescue her. And since he and his this legion that he was in were chasing a bunch of very wicked sorcerers out of the way, they sort of feared to do that because they thought she was some sort of trap. It was a very mysterious cavern where they found her. And so he tells Dante this story and how the dream has continued to plague him all these years, and that it's become so intense in the past 2 years that he's afraid that he'll go back and actually go do it, because she offers him the jewel in exchange for her freedom. And in the dream, he looks into the jewel and he sees some very bad things. But he also wants it. It supposedly can give you your fondest desire. And so he's nervous about it. And he says, if I can't get rid of this dream, I'm going to kill myself. And God says, well, okay, let me look into it. And so he can look into it. And the woman in the dream, he experiences the same thing. And at the end of one of the sessions with it, he does believe he can destroy it because it's something of enchantment. It's not just a normal dream.
Right.
And he starts messing around with it, and the woman actually looks at him and says, "What are you doing?"
Very cool.
And then he discovers that he does take it away from the man, but it's his dream now.
Right. Interesting. So,
and it sets him on a journey.
Does this bring resolution to Dante's character, or
eventually it does. Eventually it does. He's driven. He's always been a loner. He's in a state where, because of things that happened in the second book, he was essentially a double agent who went bad.
Right.
And very few people know exactly what he was doing, why he was did what he did. And so he still feels very much alone, even though there are some people who try to convince him that he can sort of come out now.
Mm-hmm.
It's very difficult, you know, that coming out of a deep cover operation is very difficult.
Right.
And especially when you're not sure, and nobody's really sure of which side you ended up on, and whether you became one with the people you were investigating or didn't, and that question lingers. So, there he has anger issues, definitely, and he begins to fear something inside him, aroused by this dream and by events that follow on from it. He's beginning to be afraid of his own character as well.
Fans will find this to be a satisfactory
I think so. I did.
And that's the most
and you know
thing, yeah.
you have to write it for yourself, because absolutely. You know, you have to write to your own satisfaction. But when I sat and read it, you know, a couple of weeks ago, when I read it through that last time, I was very satisfied with the ending. Excellent. So I hope my readers will find it as well.
So I'd read in a review a compliment of your writing, that the entirety of exploration and actions in the book are plot-driven. So do you think other fantasy books are kind of weighed down by too much backstory and description?
Yes. I think any book that has to begin with a, this is what's happened so far, that's a problem. And it's not that mine are light on plot, and certainly not light on character. You know, I consider my work character-centric first, and then world-centric next.
Yeah, in your description, that really comes across.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that, you know, sometimes I have to think, well, okay, how is this change in this person going to happen? You know, that's what I go looking for. I do feel like stories get burdened down with too much, and that it's always this juggling act at the beginning. Whenever you're writing a series, when you start book two or you start book three, I've only done one that's any longer. I have done one 4-book series. Mm-hmm. And when you start that, you say, how much do I tell? You know, what does a reader who picks this up, who hasn't picked up the others, what do they need to know? And, of course, once you start thinking, what do they need to know, then, unfortunately, you start putting down things that they need to know rather than letting the story drive what you tell.
Right.
And somebody from somewhere, I got a wonderful, it was from my first editor, who said, that as we were talking about, so Revelation, which was my second book that was published, it was the first that I wrote under, having a publishing contract, under a deadline and so forth. And of course, I was struggling. It was the second book of a series. And I, you know, put things in there. And she said, every piece of backstory should be triggered by something in the current action. That you shouldn't have a character standing there thinking about what has come before, but you have a piece of the action that rouses feelings related to, I guess I interpolated the feeling part, but you know, it brings to mind action that's happened in the earlier book. And that way you can be sure that the reader will know what he or she needs to know, and not excess. And I constantly go back and pare down what I put in at the beginning of a sequel, because I tend to put too much because I'm essentially reminding myself. If you can put it off till later in the book until it's needed, or if you can say, well, you know, can they make sense of this if they don't remember? And because paring that down as much as you can, I think really moves you into a sequel faster.
Do you write these sequels with the assumption that readers have read the earlier books, or do you try to make it approachable enough that someone can pick up with...
I try to make it approachable, yeah, but not confined.
Right.
So I've had people say they picked up the 4th book of The Bridge of Darnath, or they've picked up Restoration, the 3rd of the Rykera books first, and were able to make sense of them, and I feel like that's a great compliment.
Yes, definitely.
But there comes a point where you cannot burden your current readers, because that's the balance you have to strike. Do you want to hammer the readers who are following the series, who are reading them 1, 2, 3?
Right.
You don't want to slam them.
Reintroduce all the world building, all the
characters.
Yeah, say,
here we are again. Yeah. And you think, okay, we're going to explore. And of course, one of the things I try to do as well is to not over-define the world in the first book. I want to make it clear. I want to make it rich. I want to leave the reader with an impression that there's more to it. And that way, when you come to the second book, you can develop those aspects of it, and you don't have to retread, you know, the old ground so much either. So
we've talked to a number of science fiction authors that have a background in math or science. So it's interesting that yourself, as a mathematics major, has gone to a fantasy writer.
Yes.
Do you have any explanation? Is it just kind of two disparate interests?
No. I think it all follows. For one thing, I've always been a reader. Always. I've read, you know, every genre. There's maybe a couple, like hard Western, you know, pure Westerns I never read unless I was at my grandparents' house in the summer and ran out of other books to read. And I'd read my grandfather's Zane Grey collection. That's the only time I would read them voluntarily. Yeah. And I've never read category romance. I don't mind romantic plots in other books, but I don't read category romance. But otherwise, I read a lot all my life. And but math, and then later my software engineering career, mm-hmm. I always say that I feel like software engineering and fantasy go together, not because all good software is fantasy. No, that's not it. But it's from the idea that you start with premises and you can make anything happen.
Right.
By connecting, you start with, you know, some basic premises for your world, whether it's, you know, telepathy, whether it's magic of some particular kind, whether it's the fact that the gods are real or that dragons are the weapons of war or whatever right. You start with premises and you connect the plot elements with logic and you can make anything happen, just like you can in software, truly.
So does this mean when the world building goes awry and you introduce things that just mess up everything, all their elements in your plot, that's the equivalent of a software bug?
That's right. Well, it means when I get stuck or when something isn't feeling right, something I want to happen, I can make anything happen in my books, but sometimes I have to go back. I can't just force it to happen. Because of who I am, because of this background I have, I have to say, why would he do that? What would make him do that? And if I, you know, so if I get to this point and I really want this to happen, I have to go back and I have to feed that in. Okay, so he gets seasick all the time. All right, that makes it, because it's very convenient that he'd be seasick here, but I have to make that happen. Right. Or that, you know, his magic comes when he gets seasick, or, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
So I have to connect those things. And so I feel like there. And plus, I will say, the last software lab that I worked in, there were probably 110 people, of whom perhaps 70% had some active creative hobby, and a lot, whether it was writing, whether it was music. There were many musicians, semi-pro musicians,
those
amateur
really
musicians.
Go hand in hand.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, because there is no profession really more creative than engineering.
Right.
Think about it: problem solving and using what's at hand to make something work, make something beautiful.
And it's certainly a perspective that allows you to just take a problem and really, you know, have the personality that's necessary to dig
into
it.
That's right. I mean, that's what I do. I make lists, you know, for myself. Yeah. I write out questions when I get stuck, when I think, oh my gosh, these three secondary characters, they are all identical. They're all smart. They're all good looking. They're all assertive. They're everything Carol always wanted to be. All right, now, so I sit down and my analytical mind says, all right, I sit and make a list and say, okay, well, she has to be assertive because of who she is, but she doesn't have to be well-read. In fact, her people don't read. Why would I ever think that? You know, she doesn't have to be good-looking. She doesn't have to, you know.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden I have three, and it's a method of thinking, because I believe that writing is a product of hard thinking, and that writing a good story is a product of hard thinking. And so my approach is this sort of mathematical engineering approach.
I like that. Well, thank you so much for your time. It was an absolute pleasure to have you here. And we'll definitely, you know, put the word out about the forthcoming books.
So, all right. Well, thank you very much. Yeah.